Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for coming out to be in this discussion this evening with us. I'd like to say again that we appreciate Pat agreeing to participate in this debate, and it is a pleasure for me to engage in this discussion, and I am in the affirmative this evening, and so I will revisit a couple of my points from my first affirmative, and then I will endeavor to deal with as much as I possibly can the affirmative arguments that Mr. Donahue made in setting forth his view this evening. While he made several of them, I may not be able to in complete cover all of his arguments in this one 15-minute speech, but Pat, please don't come up in your next speech and pretend like I'm not going to answer them, because I didn't, because I have them all listed here, and I'm going to do my best to get to all of your argumentation, even if it doesn't occur in this speech.
By the way, I see I skipped over your John 5:19 argument. That was inadvertent.
Okay, that's no problem. We can go ahead and put up chart number. Never mind, don't worry about it. My chart on Acts chapter 2. Go ahead and put that up. Chart number 28. Acts chapter 2, I believe, was the... He answers my Acts chapter 2 argument by pointing out that I focused and highlighted on the determinate counsel. And I believe it made mention to the fact that I pretty much skipped over, didn't have a whole lot to say about the foreknowledge part, but that is not at all the case. If you were listening to my argument when I made this, I pointed out that it was not just, because remember I said what his response to my argument was going to be, that it was foreknowledge, and so I said it's not just foreknowledge, because I wanted to go ahead and get to the point of difference in the discussion tonight, and I admitted that foreknowledge was there, but it wasn't just foreknowledge. It was also the determinate counsel, and as chart 29 says in Acts 4, that it was predestined to be so. Now, here's the point under consideration, and here is the point of the argument that I'm going to continue to make from this idea that Christ was predestined to die sinless. And if I understand correctly, Mr. Donahue concurred with that point in his first negative, that Christ was predestined to die for sins. And he, of course, admits that that was a sinless death. Chart number 21. Chart number 21. Here he says that it was predestined that Jesus would die for sins. Chart number 34. It was predestined that Jesus would die for sins. His fifth question in our written debate, is God smart / powerful enough to know with certainty that something is going to happen in the future, foreknowledge, without forcing it to happen that way, predestination? So according to this question and what he has forwarded even this evening, predestination equals forcing it to happen. Now my point is that the sinless death of Christ, according to even Pat's definition of predestination, was forced to happen. Not just the death of Christ, but the sinless death of Christ was forced to happen. Now his argument would seem to me to limit that what was forced to happen was only the death of Christ and not the sinless death of Christ. But he said in chart 21 that he was predestined to die for sins, not just die. So it wasn't that a death was predestined, but what was predestined was a death for sins. And answer to question number 3 tonight, if Jesus sins, he cannot die for sins. Now he says, if that's predestined, the sinless part, in reference to him dying sinless, then he brings up the Judas argument. Was Judas also forced to betray Jesus? No, Pat. And here is the reason why. The reason why Judas was not forced to betray Jesus is because Judas' betrayal of Jesus has no regard into whether or not he dies for sins. Anybody could have denied Jesus and he would have still died for sins. Judas betraying him is only relevant to his death, but not his redemptive death. So that Judas doesn't have to betray him for him to die for sins. But one thing that does have to occur for him to die for sins is he has to live sinlessly. And that is the difference between the foreknowledge of Judas betraying Jesus and the sinless life of Christ. You see, Judas' betrayal of Jesus isn't necessary to him dying sinless, but a sinless life is. And if him dying for sins was forced, he says it's predestined. Give me chart number 21. He says he was predestined not just to die, but to die for sins. And he could not have died for sins if he himself had sinned. In answer to my question number 3 tonight. Now, if Jesus had died for, if Jesus had sinned, then he would not have died for sins. Therefore, if he had sinned, him dying for sins wasn't predestined or forced, as Mr. Donahue says that it was in our written debate. How can you have a sinless death being forced, and then sin still being a possibility? If he was forced to not only die, but die sinless, therefore any means that would have rendered the sinless death impossible by very nature of that fact would have been impossible itself. Now the reason why anybody could have betrayed Jesus is because the betrayal was not necessary to the sinless death, but a sinless life was, and if the sinless life was forced as he says it was in this, or the sinless death, dying for sins is forced, then therefore anything that would have prevented the sinless death or him dying for sins could not have occurred, or else him dying for sins was not predestined. Do you understand the difference tonight between Judas' betrayal and that it's not necessary to him dying for sins? Anybody could have betrayed. It didn't have to be Judas. Anybody could have betrayed. But that is irrelevant to him dying for sins. The only thing that is relevant to him dying for sins, the one thing that must be in order for him to die for sins, is a sinless death. And how can the ends be forced and the contradictory means that would have caused a different ends not also necessarily be eliminated? And that one thing that is necessary for him to die for sins is that he be sinless. And if being forced to die for sins, if that's something that was forced, and he says it was, he agrees that it is by the fact that he used the word predestined. Remember his little distinction? Foreknowledge means you know it's going to happen. Predestined means you force it to happen. Well, if he was forced to die for sins, and sinlessness was necessary to die for sins, then it would be impossible for him to have sinned, therefore making him incapable of dying for sins, which he already admitted was forced. Now, I believe you as an intelligent audience can understand quite the distinction there this evening. Now, Patrick, I really wasn't expecting you to do this, as I made it very clear in the scholarship that I quoted in reference to John 5:19. I told you in the first speech I made reference that I'm not quoting this as authoritative. And then you got up here and acted like I quoted it as authoritative. I did not, and I made it clear that when I quoted those references, I was not quoting it as authoritative any more than you did when you quoted an authority in our written debate. I made that very clear. I did the same thing in my speech that Pat admits he did in our written debate, was he quoted someone that he liked the way they said it. That's exactly what I did with those commentators when I quoted them in reference reference to John 5 and verse 19. And so just make sure you understand that I did not quote them as authoritative. For only the Scripture is authoritative in establishing doctrine and establishing what is in reference to faith and morals in the life of the believer. Not only did I quote those scholars, not only did I quote the commentators and scholarship, I also showed you by the context that the Son can do nothing of Himself. Was it talking about combing your hair, brushing your teeth, taking the dog out for a walk? But it was in reference to breaking the Sabbath, which Jesus, if He had done it, would have been a sin. And the reason why He did not and could not have broken the Sabbath is because He said the Son can do nothing but what He sees the Father do. What's my time, Tommy?
Five and a half
minutes. Okay, Hebrews chapter 4 and verse number 15. I am going to make one preliminary remark on Hebrews chapter 4 and verse number 15. I will, in my third and fourth speeches, come back and comment more on Hebrews 4:15. Okay, Pat? Just so we have that understood to start with. Chart number 97. Chart number 97. Now, Pat almost repeatedly said that Christ was tempted like we are. Kept on repeating, He's tempted like we are. He was tempted like we are. Hebrews 4:15 says Christ was tempted like we are. And he may have mentioned it one time, but if He did, it was probably only once. As I remember, and of course, my memory is not no more infallible as I am, so if He said it more than once, but the overwhelming majority of the time is that He said He was tempted like we are. Now, here's the difference between my opponent and I tonight. The Bible version versus my opponent's version. The Bible version says He was tempted in all points like we are. It doesn't say He was tempted like we are. It says He is tempted in the points like we are. Yet without sin. And I'm going to attempt to prove to you in a later speech that even Mr. Donahue doesn't believe that Jesus was tempted the way we are tempted. And I'm going to probably attempt to do that in my third affirmative speech. Now, Hebrews 2:18, I'm going to deal with this more, but I want Pat used empathize to be synonymous with the word secure in Hebrews 2:18. That is simply not the case. The word secure simply means to help. It does not mean to empathize. And if you think it does, I would like for you to provide some proof that the word secure in Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 18 means to empathize. And in fact, as I am aware, and if He shows me, I'll be happy to stand corrected, but even Hebrews 4:15 doesn't say that Jesus empathizes with us. He uses the word empathize repeatedly, but I do not think that empathy is anywhere in those passages, and I am going to deal with Hebrews 2:18 in my next speech as well. I want to deal with something here very specifically, and the reason why I'm skipping those things, Pat, to deal with what I'm about to deal with now is because your question on if Jesus could not have sinned, why did the devil even try to tempt Him to sin? Now, I will admit in our written debate, for some reason I overlooked that. It wasn't intentional. I believe He made reference to it two, maybe three times in our written debate. The question, why did the devil attempt to get Jesus to sin? Why did He try to tempt Him if Jesus could not have sinned? Let me suggest to you as a possibility, chart 109, that the wilderness temptation is the first recorded example of Jesus having an encounter with the devil in the New Testament or in His earthly ministry. Now notice Matthew chapter 4 and verse number 3, Luke chapter 4 and verse number 3, the devil says, if thou be the Son of God. If you be the Son of God, do this. How is the term, if thou be the Son of God, used in Scripture? Next chart. Alright, if thou be, how is it used? Matthew 27:39-40. And they that passed by reviled Him, wagging hanging their heads and saying, if thou be the Son of God, come down from the cross. Luke 23:36-37, and the soldiers also mocked him, coming to him and offering him vinegar and saying, if thou be the King of the Jews, save thyself. Luke 23:39, if thou be the Christ, one of the malefactors. The one, not the one that believed on him, the one that didn't say, if thou be the Christ. John 10:24, the Jews came round about him, saying unto him, how long dost thou make us to doubt? If thou be the Christ, tell us plainly. Obviously, from John chapter 10 and the rest of these passages, every time the phrase, if thou be the Son of God or the Christ is used, it's always from a position of doubt and unbelief. Next chart. I hope I can finish this argument before. Now, in Matthew chapter 4, Mark chapter 1, even in the same chapter, as you will see, 1:12 is where Jesus was tempted. 1:12 is the parallel account where the devil said, if thou be the Son of God. Now, 23, a man with an unclean spirit in the very same chapter cried out, said, I know thee who thou art. Luke 4, the wilderness temptation again, the same chapter. A man which had a spirit, an unclean spirit, cried, said, I know thee who thou art. Now, in the wilderness temptation, the question by the devil was, if thou be. Every point after the wilderness temptation, it is never again, if thou be the Son of God. It is always, I know who thou art. It is a statement of unbelief.